The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Hello and welcome to Knowing Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower and put you in charge of your case. I'm your host, Attorney Noah Davis, broadcasting live from the studios of KLAY 1180 AM in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington. Be sure to check out our website at www.knowyourrights.com as we post the audio for each show as well as follow-up information on each program. You can also email me at noah@knowyourrights.com. Many of you do. Keep them coming. I do the best that I can to answer the questions as quickly as I can. You can also suggest topics for next shows, and I really appreciate that too. You can visit this station, clay1180.com, for more information on me, the show, and additional programming on this, your conversation station. Today's episode is episode 33 of Know Your Rights, Family Law and Divorce. This is a topic that we visited in episode 8 of Know Your Rights, but we could have 10 more shows on it because it's such a big topic and there's so much interest in it. We're going to expand, though, on that episode number 8 back from February 20th, 2018 of this year. So, and why? Well, it's a hugely important topic. It affects thousands of us annually. For example, according to the Department of Human Services, in Washington State in 2016, there were 24,499 divorces finalized, with over half involving one or more children in the household. In Pierce County, where we're located, for the same year, 2016, there were a total of 2,869 divorces. Just over half of those, just like with the state stats, just over half of those involved one or more children. So you're talking about thousands of people being affected by family law issues each year. And many, many of those individuals cannot afford an attorney and end up being represented by themselves, called pro se, by themselves. And that's really tough to represent yourself in a family law case that can be complicated, even though there's family law forms that have been developed to help you out. It's still a very complicated process. It's a very intimidating process. And sometimes you got to do it alone. And even though there's some court resources available to help you out, for the most part, you really are on your own in these types of cases. So the more information that you can have, the better off you'll be, obviously. And one way to get information is this show, resources that we have on our website. Email me with other questions that you have, and we'll keep trying to develop this topic. Because besides traffic tickets, probates, maybe car accidents and bankruptcy filings, family law account for one of the most common ways that we're going to have an interaction with the court system. And if you recall from the prior show, in Washington State, we refer to divorce as dissolution proceedings. We're also a no-fault state. That means that you don't have to prove that your marriage is broken. You just allege that it's irretrievably broken, and that's it. In some other states, you actually have to prove fault. You have to prove infidelity or that there's some other reason to show why the marriage is broken. We often get clients that come in and they want to prove what happened in the marriage, prove what went wrong, all the bad stuff that occurred. Maybe there was drug use or there was some type of crime. And the court's going to say, and we explain to the clients, the court's going to say, I don't want to hear all that stuff. It's irrelevant to this case. I don't want to hear why, who did what, or who cheated on who. It doesn't matter. We're here to divide up the assets. We're here to divide up the debt and move on. But, you know, it's really personal to us, these types of cases, and it's hard to sometimes divorce us, our feelings, from the case itself. Child custody and visitation, you know, on the other hand, might be relevant to some of those bad conduct. There are situations where if there is maybe drug use or there's a crime being committed, the court is going to want to know about those issues as it relates to parenting, so child custody and visitation, and also the financial arrangements, how they've been handled in the past. Maybe there's a gambling addiction, or maybe there's been a dissipation of assets because someone's got some financial problems or debt on their own on the side that they're hiding or something. So sometimes those things are relevant, but you got to just tie it in. You got to tie it in and not just stand on that alone. Remember also that we're a community property state, which puts us in a minority among the states of the U.S. There's only 9 of the U.S. states that are community states. Most of those are in the western U.S. And what does community property mean? Well, in its barest terms, it means that when you get married, the law presumes that you each have an undivided, more or less equal share in each other's property. There are, of course, exceptions to that, and then there's exceptions to the exceptions. For example, property that you had prior to the marriage, such as you fully paid off a condo in Hawaii, for example, or you have a car, or you inherited some funds from a family member, those remain your separate property. You don't have to create a document that says that it's separate. It's just separate. Still, you can have a separate document, and it's smart to do so, just to be clear. You can also end up commingling some of those assets that you had prior to the marriage, and you lose that separate nature. Particularly, that's the case. It's not so much the case of a car, but it really is the case of a funds. If you had some inheritance funds in an account and you end up adding your spouse's name and you're jointly using those accounts to pay off joint bills, you might end up commingling that and losing that separate property nature of that account. Income. Community property also means that your income, and people don't really get this, and maybe because of the confusion with separate property states, your income, even though it's one spouse's income, after you're married, that income becomes the property of both spouses. It's community property, meaning it's more or less 50-50 owned by each spouse. If one person's income is paying off the mortgage, that means that both parties' income, because they got the 50-50 share in it, they're both paying for that mortgage, and they're both contributing to the appreciation of the value of that home. Subject at dissolution to some inexact science about how we divide up that asset. You know, you can always have a premarital agreement, and it's such a great idea to get a premarital agreement and at least talk to a lawyer before you get married to see if you really need one. But boy, is it a great idea to have one. You know, it can provide that each party's income will remain their separate income. You can have an agreement that says we're going to create a joint account in which we will each contribute some portion of their own wages together into this joint account to pay joint expenses. It can say that spouse one's going to continue to pay the mortgage because that was their property prior to marriage. They'll pay the property taxes. The other spouse will contribute to utilities, furniture, living expenses, that sort of thing. You also need to be concerned about 401ks, IRAs, and other retirement accounts because those are community property unless accounted for in a premarital agreement. Although the value of those accounts prior to marriage remain the separate property of that spouse that had it. Before you got married, it'd be a good idea to make a list of your separate property, of yours and your spouse's. And then also, again, you can list out what you believe going forward you'd like to treat as separate property. You can have this separate property agreement that the spouses can sign, and that can help override the default community property rules. But you really need to talk to a lawyer about that. It's just the smartest thing that you can do. And sometimes it's not just assets, but debts that you're worried about. Maybe at the time you're getting married, maybe one spouse has a lot of debt. Maybe they have student loan debt. Maybe they have a bunch of credit card debt, and they don't want the other spouse to be responsible for that. And you get married, and the credit card companies forget when debt was incurred. They just start to see that people are married, and they should be jointly responsible, and they start to look after both spouses, especially if one has income, more income than the other. You'd want to create a separate property document to talk about that debt, to keep it separate and to make sure it's separate. And then when you pay off that debt, one spouse does, it should be from their separate funds and not from joint funds. So there's a lot to talk about with family law. There's a lot of issues for us to delve into, but we're going to talk next about the actual divorce process. So coming up after the break, I'll be joined by Joe Lambino from the law firm Lambino Martino, and he's going to take us through the actual divorce process. There's a lot there and a lot for us to go through and a lot that you need to know. Stay with us. You're listening to Know Your Rights on KLAY 1180 AM. Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights. If you listen to my show, you know I'm a big fan of legal plans. One of those plans is Legal Shield. With the Legal Shield membership, you won't have to worry about the cost of legal help because Legal Shield membership helps you pay for the legal services you need when you need them. Why don't you visit LegalShield.com and check out the plans which start at $24.95. Legal Shield, providing access to legal services since 1972.
Hey, you wanted to see me?
Jack, legal has some concerns about the new Jack in the Box marketing campaign.
Why? It just says my teriyaki bowls are better than ever, with your choice of steak or chicken, plus veggies and white or brown rice covered in our teriyaki sauce. And then everyone's gonna love my bowls.
Right. You can't say that last part.
So I can't talk about my sweet bowls?
No.
Can I say my bowls are meaty?
Absolutely not.
But I already put up the billboard that says enjoy my bowls.
Oh, no.
Try my teriyaki bowls, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only at participating restaurants.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there, see how we can help you, and if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com. And we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Joining me on Noah Your Rights is Joe Lombino from the firm of Lombino Martino. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Noah. It's nice to be here.
Joe, you're a bit of a general practitioner, but you have a history of family law. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I've been in practice since 1984, admitted to the bar in California, Oregon, Washington, and up in Alaska. And over that time, I've represented a lot of people in various areas of law, but a lot in family law.
And you have this, your firm has a relationship with Legal Shield. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Lombino Martino started in 2005. And our firm is the provider law firm for Legal Shield. And what that means is that members of Legal Shield are able to call into our office anytime they have any type of legal issue, Noah, anything that they want to talk about. Maybe they want to refinance their house. They have some questions. They want us to review some documents. Maybe there's a legal dispute. We need to send a letter to the opposing party. Whatever we can do to assist members of Legal Shield, that's what our firm does. We have 26 attorneys, all varied from different areas of law they're specialists in. And we receive anywhere from 300 to 500 calls a day. And like I say, helping people every day.
So people pay a membership to join Legal Shield, which is a prepaid legal plan. And then when they end up having your firm provide legal advice to them and answer their questions, if they end up having a family law case that needs additional representation, does your firm take on that representation? And how does that work? Is it reduced hourly? Or
that's a good question. Advice is one thing where we provide consultation over the phone. But if they need active legal representation, our firm will take it on, depending if it's geographically, if it makes sense. If it's in Pierce County or South King County or Kitsap, we'll go ahead and do that. If not, if the Legal Shield member, let's say, is in Spokane, we have attorneys that we work very closely with that are on our referral directory list, that we will make sure and get them an attorney. And then you're right, there is a discounted rate. So the Legal Shield member will pay 25% off the normal hourly rate of that attorney. So let's say the attorney would charge somebody like you or I $300 an hour. The Legal Shield rate is $225. And actually, that's significant, and especially in a case where it can go for a little while, those savings are significant.
Yeah, well, these cases can last for a year or longer, sometimes 2 years, and be very complicated and end up in a trial. And I've had cases that ran in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, just over $100,000, but that's significant. No one has that kind of money.
That's true.
Very, very few people have that kind of money. So, Joe, let's talk about the topic of the day, and that's family law and divorce. So let's say that someone out there listening says, I want to file for divorce. What's my first step in the process? Do I need to ask my spouse for their permission? And then regardless of your answer to that question, what do I do next? What's my next step?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, no, you don't need to seek the permission of your spouse. If you feel that a divorce is the proper remedy for your situation, you would file a summons and a petition for dissolution of marriage. And that is the initial documents that gets the whole process started.
And they can get those documents. There's a family court forms. There's a website that people can get some of those documents from. Although their documents are created to help people help themselves, they're still really complicated. They're even complicated for lawyers, but they can be found at a website, which is www.courts.wa.gov. You can also find that on the knowyourrights.com website. But there's a whole host of family law forms, and they're in a number of different languages, so Spanish, Vietnamese, Russian. But still, even though they've tried to be simplified, they can still be very weighty or difficult to wade through sometimes, can't they?
I agree with you. And it's ironic because when they put these pattern forms together, mandatory use of these pattern forms, they did so with the intention of making it easier. But you're right, in many cases, it's a challenge. It's a challenge.
So someone goes and they file the summons petition. They pay a filing fee, which is pretty hefty now. It's about $300 in most counties. Mm-hmm. So they pay the summons. Or they pay the filing fee. They file the summons petition. There's a couple more forms they have to file at the time that they file those, which is like the Department of Vital Statistics form. And then there might be some other localized form, too, that the court may require. At that point, what's the next step?
Well, to complete the process and to get what's called personal jurisdiction, the spouse, the other spouse, has to be served. And they can either be served or they can accept service. So to be served, what has to happen is someone other than the spouse who's filing the summons and petition for dissolution has to have it served on their spouse. And that could be done through a private process server, could be done through the sheriff's department, the civil division, or it can even be done by someone who's over the age of 18 and maybe a friend or a relative. As long as that individual serves the opposing spouse, the other spouse, and then has what's called an affidavit of service filed with the court file to document that that person has been served.
And there seem to be maybe an exception or two to that rule, even though that's definitely, and I'm with you 100%, that's a number one rule. And a lot of people get it wrong because they serve the petition and summons themselves, that right. The spouse that filed, and that's not valid service. There seems to be maybe a way out of that, and that's the acceptance of service from the spouse. If I think even if you are the spouse that filed, if you provide it to your spouse and they sign the acceptance of service, I think that that's going to be valid service.
It is.
And what about the, let's say they just join. Maybe they don't even sign the acceptance of service, but they sign the joinder. That might constitute valid service as well.
It is. Let me back up just 1 second on that, Noah. On the acceptance of service, I think it's very important for your listeners to understand that by signing the acceptance of service, all you're doing is indicating to the court that you are in receipt of the summons and petition. It doesn't necessarily mean you agree to anything. In fact, it doesn't mean that at all, that you agree to anything in the petition, just that you accept the service so that you don't need to be served. Now, by moving on to your next question, what the joinder is, that document actually does say, okay, I am in agreement with what is set forth in this petition for dissolution of marriage. Now, your other question is, will that serve as a, or will that provide enough before the court for the service aspect? And I think good practice would indicate you would have either service or, in the case of a joinder, an acceptance of service together with a joinder, so that there can be no question of good personal jurisdiction.
Well, let's take the case of one spouse signing the joinder. So they received the petition for dissolution from the spouse that filed, and they read it over, and they say, you know what, this is an uncomplicated case. It's pretty straightforward. They're going to keep these things that are listed there. I'm going to keep these things that are listed over here. And so I'm going to sign this joinder. Can they go ahead, after the joinder's filed, can they go ahead and just get divorced the next day?
Good question. They can't get divorced the next day. What they can do is they can lock in their agreement by signing the joinder. They can also approve the findings of fact and conclusions, or the final documents to get divorced if they would like, but they have to wait at least 90 days. That 90 days is what the legislature has determined to be a cooling off period. And it's a public policy decision on that, Noah, where the legislature really doesn't the legislature wants the people of the state of Washington to really think hard about whether or not they want to take this drastic step of dissolving their marriage, especially where there's children involved. But in all marriages where a petition for dissolution of marriage is filed, 90 days has to elapse before that, and that's the soonest the judge can enter a decree of dissolution. And the reason for that is, sometimes after a person files, and you've maybe have had this experience in your own practice, Noah, where people change their mind and they decide, you know, maybe it's not as bad as I thought. Maybe counseling is in my future. And we've seen many a petition for dissolution get dismissed.
What we need is, as you were talking about that, I was thinking what we need is a 90-day cooling off period before you get married. that should be a statutory requirement. Some people don't need to get married in the first place, but it's easier to get in than it is to get out. And that's the case even if you file the joinder and you've agreed on everything, you still have to wait till that 91 days. And you're absolutely right. I've had those situations where clients have ended up reconciling within that period of time, saying, you know what, I didn't realize it or think that we're going to do this, but because I filed this, it just changed everything. All those things that that I thought were a big deal or that my spouse was doing, we've just fixed, and we don't want to do this, or we want to stay in this for the kids. There's just no other way. And a lot of people do stay together for the kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, boy, you know, it would be great if everybody could get along and in the case of a divorce, get along in the sense of agreeing to everything and how you're going to split assets and you're going to end up having visitation or custody. But the reality is that you can't, especially if there's cases of domestic violence, which are really hard cases, not just obviously for the parties. They're hard cases for the lawyers, too. Also, if there's going to be a contested custody issue or child support's really an issue, there's contested alimony, contested debts and assets, you're not going to be able to do the joinder. I mean, there's just no way that people are going to be able to agree on how they're going to divide up things. So, you know, at the time of filing, and I think Pierce County's going this way, some courts end up having an automatic injunction or stay, and King County has gone that way. Snohomish County's been that way for a while, where restraining orders are issued against a party immediately from changing or allowing insurance policies to lapse and those sorts of things. What about in Pierce County, if you do want to make sure that you get those things done, what's the process for making sure that insurance policies don't get changed or lapsed or trying to keep the status quo?
Well, I'm going to answer that by saying, and it's important for your listeners to understand that divorce is really a two-stage process. You've got the temporary stage, and then you've got the final or the permanent stage. And so what we're talking right now is about the temporary stage. Not all cases have a temporary stage. Some can just go right from the filing and then wait your 90 days and then enter the final divorce decree, and then you have your permanent resolution. Other cases, there's many issues that have to be dealt with immediately. And that is what invokes the temporary stage, the temporary motions. And I believe after the break, we can get into that.
Talk more about that. Well, there's a lot of questions I have about how the temporary process works. And I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there that want to understand what the temporary process of a divorce is. So stay with us. We're talking to Joe Lombino from Lombino Martino on Know Your Rights on Clay1180.com. Are you faced with a legal issue that you need help on? Why not try a legal plan? One of those plans is Legal Shield. You can visit www.legalshield.com and you can learn more about what a legal plan can provide for you. Starting at $24.95, Legal Shield can provide help about debt, collection letters, bankruptcy, and family law issues, and other types of legal matters. Legal Shield, making legal services affordable since 1972.
When the day turns into night, my hash browns turn into my Jack in the Box $3 munchie mashups. Hash browns and tasty white cheese, mashed up with your choice of savory egg and bacon, buffalo chicken and ranch, or jalapenos and bacon, each for just $3. Because everything gets more interesting at night. Vampires wake up.
Oh, 9 p.m. already.
Mummies unwind.
Hot tub nice.
And the boogeyman gets his boogie on. So come try my late night munchie mashups, back for a limited time, each for just $3. Only at Jack in the Box and participating restaurants.
Hi, I'm Noah from Know Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.knowyourrights.com. See what resources are there, see how we can help you, and if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@knowyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just gonna keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, a show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. We're talking family law and dissolution. With me is Joe Lombino from the firm Lombino Martino. We're talking about the dissolution process. After you file the petition and summons for divorce, you're going to end your marriage. What's that process entail? We talked about the filing, paying the service fee, and then serving your spouse and the different manners and mechanisms of getting service. Well, once that process is done, what do you do now? And Joe was just talking to us about the temporary stage of the case, which is trying to seek a motion for a temporary order. So Joe, to bring you back in here, just before we went to the break, you were starting to explain to us a little bit about this process. Can you first tell us what the temporary nature, why we use that term, temporary orders or temporary stage of the process?
Absolutely, Noah. Like we were talking about, there are some things, when you file for a petition for dissolution of marriage, we already talked about, you have to wait at least 90 days, and that's if everything is in agreement. Typically, if it's not an agreement, you might have to wait a year, year and a half, before you get a trial date, before a judge decides how everything is going to be on a permanent basis. Well, there's a lot, as you know, that has to be done in the meantime. There are bills that have to be paid. Who's going to pay those bills? There's parenting plans, temporary parenting plans that have to be put in place. Who's going to watch the kids? Who's going to have custody? Who's going to have, or primary custody? What is the residential schedule going to be like? Is there going to be any temporary spousal maintenance? There's lots of things that have to be dealt with that will go from the time of the filing up until the final decree when a judge decides what the final order or the permanent order is going to be. So among those temporary issues, there might be some domestic violence involved. There might be issues involving parenting plans, child support, temporary distribution of property, who's going to live in the home, and those types of things.
Who's going to use what car?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that process is typically motions for temporary orders. Typically, they're show cause proceedings are what they are. And that gives the parties the ability to get into court quickly, relatively quickly, to decide those issues on a temporary basis. Who's going to be getting the car? Who's going to pay what bills, etc.?
Yeah, if it's a contentious filing, especially if there's domestic violence involved, there's going to be a restraining order. Maybe there's a protection order that's filed along with the petition for dissolution. And the biggest problem is, especially if you have children, who's going to be the primary caretaker of the child? Who's going to live in the house? Because if there's a divorce that's filed, that could be the final straw, and there could be a concern for violence. There could be a concern for the children being taken somewhere. So getting into court, especially ex parte, getting an order to show cause, and then back on the family court calendar for these temporary orders, it helps give you stability in the case, doesn't it? It helps you create a new status quo.
That's right, Noel. What the court wants to do is to protect and preserve the community estate. They want to be able to make sure that, or to the best they can anyway, through their temporary orders, that if the matter does go to trial, that the estate won't be in shambles by that point. So they'll try to preserve and protect it. But above that, more important than any of the property or debt concerns, the court is very concerned over the welfare and the health and safety of the children. And so they'll take a very, very close look at that. Now, both parties, as you know, both parties will have possibly different ideas as to what's in the best interest of the children, any children of the marriage. And it's up to the court to decide, especially at that temporary stage, as to what parenting plan would be best to preserve and protect the best interests of those children.
You know, when you go into that process, you don't have to use the ex parte process unless there's an emergency reason to get the restraining order, and you can do so without notice if there's an emergency reason. But often you can go in on that 14-day or longer family law calendar, and where you're not serving that immediate restraining order, that ex parte type one, to get that show cause, but instead just this regular 14-day notice calendar, and you go in there and you have the court decide these important issues that could end up being the status quo for the entire length of the case, for like a year until there's a trial. Established parenting, spousal maintenance, a whole host of issues, use of the family home. But you get like 10 minutes to argue for each lawyer on each side. That's about what you get. And you have tons of declarations from that you've submitted on both sides. All these arguments are made. And the judge has very limited opportunity and information on the case to make a decision. It's a really tough situation for everyone to be in. You know your case. The lawyers know the case. The spouses know the case inside and out, you know, because they know what's happening in that relationship. But to be able to give a clear picture to the judge in that short period of time is really hard. And I find it a very difficult process. And I know that it has to happen in a lot of cases because people can't agree. They can't often agree on who should have primary custody, who should have the use of the family home, who should be getting visitation on what nights. And so you have to go to court sometimes in these processes, don't you?
You do. And there's a few things about that. Number one, as you know, there is a time limit in most cases where the individual will have a chance to explain their situation to the commissioner. Usually it's the commissioner at the temporary stage. But the commissioner will have had an opportunity in advance to read all the documents. So when the party goes in to argue their case, at least they know that the commissioner will have already reviewed all of their documents. And it is important, incidentally, for your listeners to know that if they do have these types of hearings, they need to make sure and get the bench copies into the court to allow the commissioner to be able to see these documents beforehand. But if we're talking about the children, the court will take a very, very careful look at the situation. And in the event a further evaluation needs to be made, if the court still has questions, what the court will do is appoint usually an investigator, what's called a guardian ad litem, a CASA worker. There's different counties employ different individuals for this service, to do an independent, impartial investigation and then make a report to aid the court in making that all-important determination as to what residential schedule is going to be in the best interest of these kids.
Yeah, and that's the guiding standard, isn't it? It's the best interest of the child, and that's going to guide the court's determination in everything that it it ends up deciding with respect to the children. There are statutes that govern both the judge and the commissioners in reaching a decision on temporary or final custody and placement. And among those factors, I mean, they can be really detailed. In fact, the parents are supposed to submit a declaration that actually talks about the time that they're allocating to parenting and who's providing the substantial needs and fulfilling the substantial needs of the children. Doing things like dressing them, feeding them, brushing their teeth, making sure that they're changed or changing diapers, taking them to the doctor. All those things have to be listed out, including the amount of time that's spent. The court wants to know the work schedules, all those sorts of things in order to be able to make a sound decision with respect to the children.
You're absolutely right. The court is really focused, especially at the temporary stage. They want to cause the least amount of disruption to the children as possible. They want to disrupt the least amount possible as to their routine, how they've been cared for, and that's what they'll do. Now, keep in mind that even though your listeners should keep in mind that even though whatever happens at the temporary proceeding is just that, it's temporary. It's temporary because it's at the trial. If there's still a disagreement at the time the matter goes to trial, the parties will have the opportunity to finally give all the testimony and present witnesses on their behalf to further educate the court as to what they believe is in the best interest of the kids.
Yeah, you know that the temporary hearings are very important. I mean, they really are super important, and it's this first salvo in the case where you file the shot. I mean, the filing of the divorce might be the first shot in the case, and the next shot then is this motion for temporary orders, depending on who brings it. And sometimes there's a rush to be the first one in a court to bring it, and maybe that can have positive consequences by being the first one in there. Sometimes it can, sometimes it can't. But when you end up having a decision from the court, you make a good point, and that's to the spouses that feel that they didn't have the favorable end of that decision. You hang in there. Don't do anything drastic. Don't make bad decisions. This is it's a marathon, not a short sprint, and you need to follow the court orders, abide by them. And if the other spouse doesn't abide by those court orders, call them on that, because the court's going to consider that. The judge in the dissolution trial will consider that. And in fact, even the commissioner can reconsider their decision if one of the parents is not following the decisions of the court order. They might look at that decision that they made previously and they might amend it. They might change it. And that could be with respect to not giving visitation that was ordered. It could be with respect to not taking the kids to the doctor or not taking them to school. There's a whole host of issues that could come up.
You're absolutely right. In fact, we just had a trial decision where it had been reversed. Our client had been having residential time, secondary residential time. She had not been awarded primary care during the temporary stage of the proceedings. And at trial, we prevailed where our client was awarded primary custody. There is one thing, though, that if I could give some advice as to if somebody is going to go before the court on their own without an attorney, there's a couple of pointers that I think would serve them well. Number one, even though it's an extraordinarily emotional time for them, there's no question about that, they have to do whatever they can to be as objective as they can in the preparation of their pleadings, their affidavits, and in their presentation to the court. Because the more reasonable and the more objective they can be, the more likely the court will listen and give them more credibility in their discussion.
I think that's very sound advice. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about the mediation process, and we're going to talk about the actual trial process. You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay 1180 AM. Lawyers can cost a lot of money. I know. I'm attorney Noah Davis from the show Noah Your Rights. One way that you can help address the rising cost of lawyer fees is to get a legal plan. One of those plans is Legal Shield. www.legalshield.com. Why don't you have a look at their website? The plans start at just $24.95 a month. What's that? Cost of about 7 lattes in a month? It's not a lot of money, and yet it gives you access to a lawyer and can reduce the hourly rate of those attorneys while giving you some great services. Visit LegalShield.com. You won't regret it.
Hey, you wanted to see me?
Jack, Legal has some concerns about the new Jack in the Box marketing campaign.
Why? It just says my teriyaki balls are better than ever, with your choice of steak or chicken, plus veggies and white or brown rice covered in our teriyaki sauce. And then everyone's gonna love my bowls.
Right. You can't say that last part.
So I can't talk about my sweet bowls?
No.
Can I say my bowls are meaty?
Absolutely not.
But I already put up the billboard that says enjoy my bowls.
Oh, no.
Try my teriyaki bowls, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only at participating restaurants.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com. And we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Hey, America, we need to have a little talk. We've got more food than we know what to do with in this country, yet 17 million kids in America are struggling with hunger. Makes no sense. Luckily, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks has volunteers gathering excess food and getting it to hungry kids. They're kind of like food angels. Hey, become a food angel yourself by supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. We can't do it without your help. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, a show dedicated to educating you on your legal rights and resources available. We're talking about family law and dissolution. We're talking with Joe Lombino from the firm of Lombino Martino. Joe, just before the break, we were talking about temporary orders and that process, the process for getting a motion for temporary order. And we were talking about, we were focused a little bit on parenting plans and temporary custody and visitation. But I want to ask you about how that process plays out with respect to spousal maintenance, if you could address that.
Absolutely. Spousal maintenance is a principle that is governed by statute. It's RCW 26.09.090. In that statute, Noah, there are certain considerations, certain factors that a court has to take into account when there is a request by someone to have their spouse pay them spousal maintenance. Spousal maintenance is used to be known as alimony. It's the same thing. Spousal maintenance is basically money from the what we call the wealthy spouse to the less wealthy spouse. Some of those factors are the age of the party asking them for the maintenance, their emotional and physical condition. There's a few other factors, but the two main factors that the court looks at is basically need of the person who's asking for it and the ability of the more wealthy spouse to pay.
And does that apply to more or less a request for attorney fees too?
It does. Under RCW, I think it's 26.09.140, when there's a request for a payment of attorney's fees. You're right. The same concept of need versus ability to play comes into it.
So the motion for temporary orders has been heard. You've got an order. It establishes this new status quo in the case. Maybe it establishes a parenting plan, visitation. Maybe it sets spousal maintenance, awards past or future attorney fees, provides temporary use of property. Now what?
Well, if the matter is still contested, usually the attorneys, especially if attorneys are on board, they want to find out more about the estate. They want to find out everything there is to be in the best position possible to advise their client and to let them know of all their options and alternatives regarding a possible resolution. And to do that, they engage in what's called discovery. Discovery can take the place of interrogatories, which are written questions to the opposing party. It could be in the form of depositions, which are testimony under oath, typically given in the attorney's office. And sometimes it can be in the form of informal settlement conferences where parties agree to turn over such things as tax returns and deeds and that type of thing.
Sometimes the case can take some ugly turns in the during the case of discovery, in the sense of a gotcha back, and that can be you end up serving the interrogatories, and maybe there's incomplete answers in response. Maybe there's not bank statements or credit card statements that are provided, and only one spouse had access to that. And so there could be these motions to compel that are heard, and those end up taking a life of their own in the case, don't they?
They do. The before the motions to compel can take place, as you know, Noah, there is a provision in the court rules that talks about it's 26I conference, where the attorneys or the parties are obligated to call the other person and say, hey, what's up? You know, I gave you these interrogatories, and it's long past due. They're, the answers, I'm supposed to have those answers. Where are they? And the court really wants the parties to try to work that out. But if they can't, or if it's unacceptable, then you're right. It can go to motions to compel, attorney's fees, and now you have all kinds of other things happening in that case.
What about, and you mentioned this, what about trying to resolve the case? When does that happen, and how does that process work?
It can happen at any time, Noah, from the time the divorce is filed right up until what we call the courtroom step, courthouse steps on the day of trial. And it could settlement could happen any time. I've had cases settle in the middle of a trial. But usually what happens is after discovery has taken place, after the attorneys or the parties have a real good understanding of the nature and extent of their estate, a lot of times they'll agree to a process called mediation. Mediation is a wonderful tool that allows the parties the ability to really invest themselves and talk under the guidance of a trained, impartial mediator to attempt to resolve their case by way of agreement. And it's nice because the mediator is there. Clearly, everything is confidential. Nothing that's talked about in the mediation can be talked about anyplace else, especially if the matter doesn't settle and it goes to trial. Nothing that's discussed at mediation can be brought up. And it's a wonderful vehicle, especially if people do not want to go to trial, because if they can reach an agreement, as you know, Noah, if they can reach an agreement and both parties are satisfied, then that is clearly the best resolution to their case, and yeah, the least expensive one too.
Yeah, and the mediator often will say that at some stage of the mediation, they'll explain that this is an opportunity for you, the spouse, to have control over your own case, and maybe it's the last chance that you have over control, because failing this, and if you don't settle outside of the mediation prior to trial, you go to trial and you let a judge decide, you start to lose control over the results, the impact on your life. Here you have it. You have input over what the parenting plan is going to look like, what the asset division is going to look like, and you can sign off on that. And you're going to have to compromise, obviously. But when you go to trial, the way that the judge decides, it's just invariably this case. I mean, there are situations where one spouse has acted so badly and is in such the wrong, or ends up having such a poor view of the facts of the case that it's so one-sided. But in most cases, when the judge decides something, it's not what you expected, and it's always win some, lose some. No one goes away very happy. In the mediation, you still compromise. You don't win everything, but at least you can feel comfortable with the result. You still have control over that.
It is. You know, and dissolutions, and the reason a lot of attorneys are in this practice is that it's one area where there can truly be a win-win. People think in terms of divorce as the ugly cases, and sure, there are those cases, but so many more are cases that are resolved in a way where both parties can go away and feel good about the result, because through the skill of their attorneys or a skilled mediator, the estate was divided up in such a way that it benefits both parties. A parenting plan is put together that benefits the children and that both parties can live with, because they still have significant impact and input with respect to their children's lives. And it's a matter of investing themselves in their process. And to that end, and the biggest advice I could give to your listeners is when they go through the process, the single biggest things that they can do is to stay reasonable and to stay rational. Because if both parties stay reasonable and rational, what you said comes true, because they can stay in control of the process. They can stay in control of their dissolution and of their lives after the divorce.
Let's say you don't get it resolved along this way in the temporary stage or through any informal or formal mediation type episodes, and you end up having to go to trial. Can you tell us a little bit about what's expected of you at trial?
Well, if you're at trial and if you're with an attorney or without an attorney, it doesn't make any difference, because most judges will require everybody to follow the rules of civil procedure. The judges will expect the litigants to know the civil rules, both the local rules as well as the court rules. And the process is one where the parties will typically give opening statements, and then the petitioner, the one who has filed the case, will go first. And they will put on their evidence. And the evidence is in the form of testimony, and it's in the form of written documents. And those documents and that testimony should be designed and organized in such a way as to tell their story, what they want the judge to know. Now, if they're doing it correctly, all of those facts should be pointed at and directed at the applicable principles of law that the judge is going to be looking at to decide the case. After the petitioner has given their side, then the respondent puts on their case and does the same thing with testimony and exhibits. And then after that, there might be some rebuttal testimony, and then closing statements, and then the judge goes ahead and gives his or her decision.
Yeah, and that trial process can last, in some cases, just one day. Other cases, it can last a week or more. It depends on how complex the issues are, how many witnesses are testifying. But the one thing that I think pro se's, people representing themselves, have problems with and understanding is submitting these documents in advance. The court wants trial briefs, and it wants proposed orders, proposed findings of fact, proposed decrees of dissolution, proposed parenting plans in advance of the trial, not waiting till you get there to provide that information.
That's correct. It's a lot of individuals who, you know, especially if they're pro se, they think all they have to do is show up on the day of trial, and that's all they have to do, and tell their story before the judge, and everything will work out. But as you know, Noah, that's not what happens at all. They have to have many things filed in advance.
You've been listening to Know Your Rights. Joe Lombino, thank you so much for joining us today on this episode.
Noah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For more information on this topic and others, please go to www.noahyourrights.com or email me, noah@noahyourrights.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week, same time, Tuesdays at 4 o'clock. Stay safe out there.